This is Beth Darlington, paranormal investigator and owner of Access Paranormal, and you're listening to the fabulous Al Cooley and the Ghosts in the Valley podcast.
Hello and welcome. I'm Al Cooley, host of Ghost in the Valley podcast. Today is part two of my conversation with Dave Hodrian. Dave is the chairman and investigator for the Birmingham UFO Group, also known as BUFOG. The Birmingham UFO Group is one of the most active UFO groups in the UK. And I'll be back with my conversation with Dave Hodrian right after these messages.
Learned with a phone one here. Otherwise known as Charles, and you can find me on Instagram and Twitter. But I also host a podcast called Nerd with a Phone Podcast, and the number one question any podcaster gets, what is your podcast about? Well, I cover entertainment, news, music, video games, television, comic books, and other hobbies. We say get nerdified. What does it mean? It means we get happy. All right. Check out Nerd with a Phone Podcast on IndieBlastNetwork.com.
Here is a promo for the UFO card game UFO Wave by Dave Hodrian that will be out soon on Amazon.co.uk with plans for international orders in due course.
Are you receiving me?
Yes, Commander. Loud and clear. What are your orders?
I need you to get out there and cause the mischief. But watch out. As always, the humans will be there to stop you. Their military patrols the skies. They watch us from the ground. And the less said about those pesky men in black, the better. You were authorized to use our highly advanced craft to accomplish your goals. And don't forget to make the most of our abilities, too. The humans won't know what hit them. UFO Wave, the tactical card game of alien supremacy.
The UFO Wave card game will be available Amazon.co.uk. Okay, today is part two with my conversation with Dave Hodrian. Dave is the chairman and investigator for Birmingham UFO Group out of the UK. Dave has investigated hundreds of UFO sightings, and Dave has also been involved in over 100 contact cases around the world. If you haven't listened to part one, it's the episode before this one. I encourage you to go back and listen to that one because there's some really, really cool cases there that Dave has worked on. I mean, there's so many. If I went over the whole list, I'd probably do half a season just with Dave. Welcome to the show, Dave. I'm excited to listen to some more of your stories in part two.
Thank you very much, Al. Lovely to be back.
I'm going to get right into these cases because they're so interesting.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, it's my bread and butter. It's what I do. As people who've listened to part one will know, I'm a global investigator. So although I'm based in Birmingham in the middle of England, if anybody contacts me from anywhere in the world, I'll pick up and investigate those cases because it is, of course, a global phenomenon. It doesn't really matter to me where people are contacting me. Obviously, in this day and age, we've got the internet and everything, so I can speak with them almost like I'm in the same room as them. Obviously, it's sometimes hard to get out to locations to get location photographs and things like that. But we've got Google Maps for all that, and sometimes I get the witnesses to send me photographs as well. So, we're going to start with some really fascinating contact cases, actually. And these are all ones that have come in over recent years. And I'm going to start with a case from Southampton, which is a city right down at the southern end of England, right on the coast. And it involves a lady named Tina Bird. As I said in part one, if I reveal anybody's names, it's because they've given permission. Tina is a repeat contactee. And she came to me in 2017. And she's actually bravely kind of gone on the record with this, gone a bit more public than many experiencers do. And I've actually spoken alongside her. We've given joint talks and numerous groups and conferences around the country on her experiences together. And she's currently also putting together her own conference, which is actually taking place in April next year down in Southampton. And I've been invited to talk at that. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how that goes. But yes, yeah, Tim's had many, many experiences throughout her life. It's a very, very big case. And I'm going to hone in on a number of these experiences that are particularly interesting. Her experiences include all sorts of things as abductions, visitations with beings, paranormal incidents, numerous UFO sightings. Some of the encounters, some of her abduction experiences have resulted in body markings, which we've got photographs of, numerous photographs, potential alien implants, and also internal injuries that rarely have been backed up by actual medical records. So she's actually been in for numerous operations throughout her life, and things have been found inside her that shouldn't have been there, essentially. And then people are, and the doctors have been confused by what's been found. And we've got actual written testimony from the hospital stating this. So it's really, really good evidence on that side of things. Also, very similar to in part one, I discussed the lady in Buxton who has bought the hybrid baby. And Tina's had an experience extremely similar to that, but instead of take place in her home environment, it took place aboard a craft during an abduction experience. But the experiences I wanted to pick up on, especially, first of all, I'm going to talk about the potential implants. It's quite fascinating to me when you get cases involving a potential implant extraction, or even when something's detected, because it's a side of the subject that we don't see that often in cases. Now, it's entirely possible that many experiencers who've had abduction experiences might have these inside them and not even know. They might go around for years without even realizing. And it's quite rare when one's actually found like this. But in this case, we seem to have potentially two. And we don't have either of those to examine, which we'll get to. But the first potential implant extraction took place back in 1999, and it started one morning. She woke up and felt intense pain in her right buttock cheek. It was kind of like the sting of a bee, and it was very, very uncomfortable. And she felt it, and there was she could feel a lump just underneath the skin. And the pain got worse and worse and worse, and she tried to ignore it at first, but after a while it was really intense. And she got her husband to actually cut into her skin using a pair of tweezers. Apologies if anybody's squeamish listening to this. So they made a small incision and took out an object that was just underneath the skin. And what they found was this spherical-looking object. It appeared to be covered in black membranes. When they broke apart these membranes using the tweezers, inside they found what looked like a small silver ball bearing, so a small silver sphere. There was no sign of injury on the skin of how it had got there. She had no pain there before or anything. It was just there. And they actually tried to cut into this ball, which seemed to be metallic. It was bright silver, shiny. They tried to break into it, and it actually broke the end of the tweezers. So this thing was extremely solid. Now, she didn't know what that was back then. This is years before she looked into her experiences or really knew that what she was experiencing was contact. A lot of her realization in that came out through the investigation that I did with her, although for a number of years before that, she'd had inklings that there was that this might have been going on, but back then she didn't know what it was, so unfortunately just chucked it away, threw it in the bin, just thought it was some kind of splinter. So it was a potential there that was an alien implant. Now they don't often cause pain like that, but in this case seemed to have.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the implant. I mean, is there anywhere like people can go to see these photos, or?
Yeah, they didn't photograph it. So this is just from her testimony of what happened, because back then they didn't know what they had.
Yeah, because I've had other cases where like there's implants,
Yes.
I never heard it described that way.
Yes.
That's something new to me.
Yes, an interesting one.
Because most of them are like little chips or something, like behind the neck or in the leg or...
Yeah, they can be found various places. And they, there was a case investigated from Nuneaton, which is near to Birmingham. And the lady had one in her wrist, and it was a kind of rounded, triangular shaped thing. And we never managed to get an X-ray of it because she didn't really. I tried to push for a private X-ray, but she wasn't that bothered because it wasn't causing her any pain or anything. And she, so it just goes to show that even when people are having these things happen to them, they're not always out there to get all the evidence on record. But whatever this thing was, it was metallic, and I felt it underneath the surface of her skin, and it was setting off a metal detector. So really, really interesting. So yeah, these things do happen, and that was after she'd had visitation experience. But I'm moving. This is a completely separate case now. I don't want your listeners to get confused. That's a separate case. But yeah, then many cases you don't seem to have implants, or if they are there, they're not detected. So it's quite rare, really. It's unfortunate that she never kept it because she didn't know what it was. Now the second time it happened, I'm going to move forward many years to the spring of 2014, and we're going to backtrack in a minute and go over some other interesting things that happened. But this one's really odd. It's happened in the spring of 2014, and Tina had gone round to visit her mother's house, and when she went to grab the front door handle, there was a sharp pain in her right hand, and she looked at it, and below the finger of her right hand there was a lump. And she was touching it, and it was quite irritable. So she was worried about it from a health perspective. So went to her GP to ask what it was. The GP performed an X-ray, and he informed her that there was something present inside her hand, but he was unable to confirm what it was. And what he suggested was that she should go to hospital for a day surgery to have this thing extracted from her hand.
Mm-hmm.
So she booked into the hospital, and a few days later went in for that and had a minor operation under a local anaesthetic. Now, they pulled the object out of her hand. She was obviously not knocked out for this, you know, because it's quite small. So they cut into her hand and took this object out. And what she said was the object removed in the tweezers. She only saw it. She didn't see it up close. But the object removed looked very, very similar to what to before. It looked like a kind of rounded thing covered in membranes again, almost very, very similar to what had been taken out many years before. Now, after the operation, unfortunately, the surgeons, what they'll do, they'll stick it in a jar and send it off for analysis. Yeah, so she wasn't able to keep hold of it or anything like that. I just took it away. But interestingly, after the operation, the surgeon and the other people in the room, they seemed puzzled. And what they said to her, they said that they'd never seen anything like it before. Whatever it was something unusual. Now, it was taken away for examination, and sadly, again, we don't have it. She never found out what happened to it.
I was going to ask her, you know, did it ever come back with a conclusion or?
No, I mean, they're not going to do that with, if you're going for hospital treatment and they take something away from, you know, usually it would be something like, say, for example, a cyst or something like that. They're not going mm-hmm. to, they're not really going to come back unless there's some kind of health reason for it and they need to get you in and it's, you know, a lot worse than they first expected or something like that. But she never found out what happened to it, unfortunately. The story doesn't end there. So they put a pressure bandage on her lower arm, on her lower right arm. And they told her it had to remain on the lower arm for the next couple of days, just while the wound on the hand healed up a bit. During the night after the operation, she had there was a white flash of light she remember seeing in the night. Nothing else, just this white flash of light. But in the morning when she woke up, she realized immediately the hand didn't ache anymore. There was some latent pain from the operation, but that had completely gone. She looks down at her arm, and at the top of the bandage, she saw a droplet of blood, but the droplet of blood wasn't down near her hand. It was near the top of the bandage. She pulled down the bandage, and what she saw was a hole going into her arm.
Wow.
A small hole that appeared to be going deeply into her arm, and there was no blood around it, really, and there was no pain. It was just this hole. And she looked on the other side of her arm, and there was another hole on the other side. She goes back to – obviously, she's very concerned about this, and she goes back to her GP. And the GP confirmed that this hole was right through her arm, and he was thinking, why can you still feel in your fingers and this sort of thing? He was worried why there was no pain coming from it. And he said to her, what have you done? You know, have you fallen on something, impaled your arm? Because obviously that's what the doctor would think, wouldn't he? And Tina said, said to me, she never sleepwalked. And obviously if she had sleepwalked and fallen on something extremely sharp, obviously she would have immediately woken up with that. Uh-huh. And she didn't. She just woke up in the morning. And she also claimed that there was nothing in her house at all. Now, obviously I can't prove that, but she said that there was nothing in her house which would have caused that sort of injury. It's really bizarre. So the wounds healed up, but she's still got them today. And there's photographs of those inside the case report, the leftover scars from those. Really an interesting thing, this. You know, was this done on purpose due to the removal of that object? Was the object an implant that was taken out from hand? And if so, was this in reaction to that, in response to that, for some reason? I've not really come across any cases where they do horrible things to people kind of intentionally, at least nothing which would have that sort of implication. I've never had anybody come to me and say, oh, we took the implant out and then they punished me in a certain way because of that. It's just a mystery. It's just really bizarre. But it just seems to be, obviously, it's the following day, the following morning after she's had that operation, and there's this other random injury halfway up on the same arm that this object's been taken out from. And that's all we really know about that. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I kind of feel bad for her, you know, because she doesn't really know the conclusion. What was it?
Yeah, yeah. If it is related to it, then it's absolutely the most extreme wound, shall we say, after effect of an abduction experience that I've ever seen in a case. Now, unfortunately, she didn't get the medical records. This one, she's got other medical records, as I mentioned, but not for this one, the whole forearm. So, you know, there is a level of trust that goes with the testimony she's provided. But we spoke for many, many hours, and I didn't see any reason at all why she should be making up all this stuff and talking for me, hour after hour with me. She's not really gaining any. She didn't try selling the story to the paper or anything like that. Yeah, so there was no alarm bells.
Two implants?
Potentially, yeah. Yeah.
I just find it fascinating, you know, that why would she – they pick her for
– Yes.
Because it had to be put in there by something or someone.
Yeah, yeah. So we don't really know what these implants actually are. I mean, many people theorize they're some kind of tracking device, but then there's many cases on record where they don't seem to have an implant. I don't believe that every single person who's taken has an implant in them or anything like that, because I think if that were the case, you could easily scientifically prove that. Sometimes these things set off metal detectors, and that's how people find them, you know, because they might go on holiday, you know, a year or so later or whatever, after they've had the thing put in, and then it goes off. And sometimes they can find them removed as well, so they can have them there for a while, and then all of a sudden they're no longer there. Really, really interesting. It's a fascinating aspect of the contact phenomena, and it's also a very physical aspect. And obviously, there's famous people such as Dr. Roger Lear in the States, who has extracted a number of these and found some really fascinating aspects to them. You know, he claimed that some of them were giving out radio waves until they were taken out of people. Other ones were seen to actually move around underneath the surface of the skin when they tried to grab hold of them. But when they're looking at the things, they just look like an odd mix of metals. They don't look like detailed alien tech. But if you think about it, if you're working covertly, that would be the best thing, wouldn't it? That if we get hold of one, we don't really know what we've got. Like if it was a detailed alien chip, like some sort of little motherboard or something like that, you'd have the evidence there, wouldn't you? But if it's a random mix of metals, so it's absolutely fascinating. I'm going to backtrack to a couple of other experiences I wanted to go through. An abduction experience that happened, very, very odd. It happened in late 2002. And around that period, she actually had numerous abduction incidents that happened in quite quick succession, sometimes within days of one another. But one of them was particularly interesting. With this one, she came round during the night. She just came round to find that she was elsewhere, as many people do. And she seemed to be attached to the underside of some kind of conveyor belt-like mechanism. There were people ahead of her and behind her. And so it was basically almost like a production line of humans. They were wearing clothes. There was no children. She said they were the ones that she could see, at least looked to be adult. And she could only kind of partially see, because she could only look round. There was something kind of attached to her back so she only had certain sort of limited movement. But everybody else appeared to be in a trance, so it was like she'd woken up, almost like she'd woken up and shouldn't be awake. And everybody else were just in this trance-like state with their eyes open. Now, I've dealt with other, in actual fact, I think I talked about this, didn't I, in the Buxton case with the with the boy that I saw, very, very similarly. So you see these similarities between cases. Now, when the experience began, she was facing something with a bright light. It was a big, round, bright white light. It was ahead of her, but the conveyor belt type mechanism, it started to move, and she starts to move to the left, and she comes out of the glare of this light. So she's involuntarily being moved along this mechanism. And once she's out of the light, she could see platforms around this. It was almost like a big spotlight type thing that was on them. And they were sending everybody through this light for whatever reason. There were a number of grey beings across there with this light that would just seem to be just getting on with things. They weren't looking at her or anything like that. They were just there and they're on these platforms. The conveyor belt kind of moved around a bit. It kept on sort of stopping and kind of moving along. And it ended up at this area that looked almost like a control room of some kind. There was lots of panels with buttons and contraptions on. And there were groups of greys. Now, interestingly, there seemed to be one taller one and then two very short ones in each of these groups, almost like they were being taught things. Really interesting. And then at the back, there was some very, very tall platforms in the distance on the far side of this area. And there was two very old looking, very squat beings standing at the back. They looked like greys, but somewhat noticeable differences to the other ones. And they were just standing there almost over watching everything. One of the greys, and again, most of the beings didn't seem to be paying any attention to her or anything. She was just looking at all this going on. But one of them near the middle of the area appeared to have sort of darker coloured skin. Its skin was also more sort of brownish. And it appeared to be holding an oval-shaped device that was letting off light of some kind. Suddenly, this being just turned and looked right at her. And it was like it knew that she was awake. So upon seeing her, it ran right towards her. It looked almost angry. She sensed it was kind of angry at her. It ran towards where this conveyor belt contraption was, leapt up into the air off the ground, because obviously she's lifted up in a standing position underneath this thing, leapt up, and it touches her on the forehead with its hand or with some kind of object that was in its hand. She, you know, it was too fast, really. Upon doing that, she instantly gets an image of a spider in her brain. So she saw this big spider up close, and then she blacks out. And that's the end of the experience. And when she next thing she knows, she's coming around, she's in her bed. The incident, it felt very vivid to her, very, very real, as a lot of contact experiences do, felt a lot more than just a strange nightmare. Obviously, if it was an individual experience, and if she had an interest in the UFO subject, you know, you might put it down to some sort of bizarre nightmare. Of course, there's a lot of very, very interesting aspects there. Now, it turns out that that Tina is arachnophobic, has been arachnophobic since childhood, so the fact that it put this image of this spider in her brain may have been done on purpose to frighten her, some kind of screen memory. So maybe punishment for being awake. We don't really know, but it's interesting that it was a spider. Mm-hmm. It's possible that she may have seen its face up close and it reminded her brain of a spider. So therefore she saw a spider. You could look at it a number of different ways, but really interesting the way that experience ended with that. Obviously, there's aspects of it that fit in with contact, such as the types of beings that are being seen, and these, and many people have reported seeing control panels or buttons and lights and that sort of thing on. But it seemed a bit of a bigger area than that, and you know, they had entire kind of rooms and areas. And one of the things that fascinated me the most were these groupings of these greys with a sort of taller one. And then shorter ones, almost like the shorter ones were being taught something. Maybe they were younger, and maybe they were a different type. We don't really know. You could interpret it lots of different ways, but mm-hmm. certainly a very interesting experience.
Would you say that the greys are like the most popular? I mean, of
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are. Yeah, they're absolutely the most commonly reported type. But there's lots of subtypes of them, you know. So you get some that are kind of quite tall, some shorter, and lots of different sort of skin tones. Sometimes they've got irises, and sometimes a lot of the time don't, just black. But sometimes they're black with, you know, with kind of noticeable irises in them. Some of the more famous cases on record, like Betty and Barney Hill and Travis Walton, in actual fact, they had irises. But more often than not, they're reported just completely black. It's really interesting. But if you think about why would they all look the same? If you look at the human species, we don't all look the same. So why would the same not apply to another species?
Right.
And then you've got the fact that they appear to be doing stuff with genetics, mucking around, manipulating genes of various kinds. And there's certainly cases I've dealt with where there appears to be, shall we say, crossbreeds between different types.
Mm-hmm.
Suggesting that they are messing around with their own genes as well as ours, maybe. This is just observation and theory based on that. I don't have any conclusions or anything like that. It's just my observations of it. So yeah, I'll move forward to this. The internal injuries that I mentioned. So towards the start, I mentioned that she's had medical records, a backup something.
Yeah. What was her name? Tina.
Tina Bird, and if anybody's in the UK, yeah, as I said, she's putting together a conference called Encounters in next April. So, on the 18th of May 2012, she unfortunately suffered from an ectopic pregnancy, which almost took her life, and she was in a very, very bad state with that. She was rushed into Princess Anne Hospital for an operation. And when she came round from that operation, luckily, there were three surgeons standing at the end of the bed. And like before, when they took the object out of her hand, they appeared puzzled, and they started to ask her interesting questions about her medical history. They were asking her what procedures she'd been in for before, and she informed them she'd never been in for any operations before. This was the first time she'd been in for a major operation, a hospital. And what they told her, they said that she had a lot of unknown internal damage. They said that it looked like her pelvis had been stabbed by needles again and again. There was damage to her pelvic bones. And they'd also removed a mass of black membranous type stuff from around the pelvic area. And we've actually got they didn't tell her what this stuff was or anything. It's possible it was congealed blood or something. But whatever this was, we've got actual medical notes confirming that damage. And they didn't know what it was or what had caused it. And it was obvious to Tina that they thought that she'd been in for operations before, and she hadn't. So absolutely fascinating. We do need to move on to other cases, but this case is huge. Yeah, we've gone over here about less than a tenth of the case. Yeah, I mean, she's had a lot happen to her, a hell of a lot. So, yeah, obviously it's all in the case report on the BUFOG website, so people can go and peruse that as they will and see the photographs. As I said, there's numerous photos in there of various body markings that have turned up, some quite dramatic.
I'll be right back with my conversation with Dave Hodrian, case number 5, right after these messages.
No Outlet Live.
Hey, I'm Jay Remy, host of No Outlet Live. If you're in a podcast that explore any and everything, check us out. We stream anywhere you listen or watch podcasts, or just type No Outlet Live, one word, in your Google search bar to find the show. Live Saturdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Facebook. No Outlet Live, your road to boredom ends here.
We're going to move on to another contact case from Moseley. It's an area of Birmingham. And this case involves a gentleman named James Brody. Now, at the time when I spoke with James, he'd just started coming down BUFOG's monthly meetings. Back in April this year, I signed him up as an official investigator for the group. So he now assists with cases and writes case reports. But he'd had a couple of fascinating experiences, which are separated by a number of years and yet joined, as you'll see. And we're going to start right back in the 14th of November 1992, when he was 18 years old. And at the time, he lived on Mayfield Road in Moseley, and just a nice little suburban area on the outskirts of Birmingham. And he'd regularly go out and walk his dog around the local neighbourhood, as many people do. So on this particular night, it was nice weather, and he was walking along Highfield Road about 7 p.m. in the evening. It's fully dark because of the time of year in November, so by that point it was fully dark. The stars had come out, but it was a clear evening. Now, as he's walking along the road, and there's nobody else around at the time, it was just quite a quiet evening in the neighbourhood, the dog suddenly became agitated for an unknown reason, started whimpering. And James wonders what's going on, and he looks around. And when he looks up into the sky, what he describes seeing was this comet-like object. It looked like a white glowing object with a tail behind it, like the tail of a comet. But the thing was moving too slowly to be a meteorite. Obviously, meteorites will cross the sky, you know, in a couple of seconds at absolute most. This thing was moving a lot slower than that. It was moving, you know, like the speed of a plane. It appeared to be about sort of 300 feet up, so it wasn't particularly high. It was quite low down, like sort of height a helicopter might fly at. As it began to move away, he's just fascinated by this thing, just moving across the sky. As it begins to move away on this straight course, it suddenly seemed to pass behind another object that was invisible or cloaked. It seemed to pass behind something a lot larger, and it briefly illuminated this curved edge of this other object, and then it was gone. It was just caught a glimpse of it like that, and then the object kind of moved out of sight, and that was it. Now, he's absolutely fascinated by this, and he wants to get home to see if he can continue to look at the sky from home. So he quickly brought us back to his house. Nobody else was in at the time. He goes up to his room, just leaves the dog downstairs, and he grabs the binoculars that he's got, and he peered out of his bedroom window to the east. So he's obviously just a normal second story. So he notices these two white orbs in the distance that appear to be sort of darting back and forth. So again, there's something else in the sky there. It doesn't look like what he's seen before, but there's still something there. He suddenly becomes aware that one of these orbs is actually moving in his direction and seems to be getting bigger and bigger. And it comes in closer and closer, and it ends up hovering over the trees at the base of his garden. Now, at this point, it had more definition. It no longer appeared as a glowing orb. What he describes seeing was a disc-shaped object, but with a flattened base at the bottom. So it was a chrome silver in color, with a kind of slight glow that might have been coming off the surrounding streetlights. Mm-hmm. He estimates it was about 100 foot across. And this disc comes to a halt at the bottom of his garden. And at this point, with it in this close proximity, he can feel this static charge in the air. He said the whole air seemed to be slightly electrified. There was no camera with him at the time. This was a long time before, you know, this is right back in 1992, so we didn't have smartphones back then, and he didn't have a digital camera there in the room or anything. He's staring at this object, and he decides to try and communicate with it. He's more fascinated with it rather than frightened, because he had an interest in the subject, yeah? So he realizes he's having an experience. He actually tries to communicate with it by his mind, and he asks it in his mind. He asks it to show him something to prove it can hear him, essentially. And in response to this, or seemingly, should we say, in response to this, the object suddenly starts to rotate in a clockwise direction until it's now vertical. So it moves around 90 degrees, and it's now vertical. And he's even more fascinated, because it seems to have answered his request. After about 30 seconds, it starts drifting closer, about sort of 20 miles an hour. So it's moving quite slowly. It comes up the garden, still in this vertical position, and he loses sight of it over the top of the window. It essentially goes over the roof of his house out of sight. Obviously, he wants to keep looking at it, so he runs down the stairs and runs out onto the front drive to continue watching it. And wouldn't you know it, object's completely vanished. As I mentioned in the case last time, Erdington, you'll see the exact similarity. So as soon as the object is out of sight for a briefest moment, it's gone. However, as he's standing out there on the drive, he sees a car coming down the road. It's his sister arriving home in her car at that point. She jumps out of the car and says, "Have you just seen that light over the house?" And James informed her that he'd seen it a lot closer, and that it wasn't just a light. So she'd seen it at a distance. What she claimed to have seen was a white glowing light come over the roof of the house, and then there was a bright flash, and it vanished. So she's essentially at a distance seen the thing leave the vicinity. Now he's absolutely fascinated by what's just taken place, but he's pretty certain it is what it appears to be. But he wants to make sure that there's no atmospheric anomalies. Yeah, he's trying to tick those off. So soon after this experience, he rings the University of Birmingham Observatory to ask if there was any unusual astronomical anomalies that were going on in the area that evening. Now, it's important to note here that when he spoke to the person on the phone, he didn't provide them his name or address. He just asked them this question. They said that that there hadn't been anything, and that's it. And he hangs up. He doesn't say anything more. He doesn't give details or anything. In the following days, he also checked the newspapers, but there was nothing at all. Didn't appear to be any other witnesses, at least no other witnesses who'd gone to the papers about it. So we're going to fast forward now a number of years, many years, to 2005. And it's now 2005. He's moved address and now lives in another area of Birmingham called Bearwood on Windham Road with his wife. And it's a normal Saturday. He's downstairs and his wife is upstairs doing some housework at the time. And there's a knock on the door, and he decides to go and answer the door, of course. And at the door is a couple of people wearing smart black suits with these long trench coat type jackets on. There's an elderly man who appears to be in his late 50s with grey hair, and then this younger lady with long hair. The lady's holding this black holal bag. They actually start by addressing him as Mr. Brody, so they knew his surname from the off. And they then asked him if they could talk with him about something he reported some time ago. That was the words that they used. Mm-hmm. And they then asked if they could come in. Now, this is really odd to him. He's thinking, what is this? Why are they asking me about things and from the past and this sort of thing? But he doesn't feel particularly threatened by these people. And he's kind of, in a way, slightly more intrigued by what they've got to say. So he decides to honor their request and invites them into the house. And they all go through to the living room and sit down on the settee. You know? And he asks them what they wanted to talk about. And at this point, the gentleman says, "We understand you reported that you saw something in the sky. We want to talk to you about what you saw." And then they go on and say, "You saw a number of things." At this point, he's very suspicious because he thinks back to it and he's pretty certain that he never told anybody about it. And when he contacted Birmingham Observatory, didn't provide his name or details. And don't forget, this is years and years on. He's moved address and everything. But he's a bit weirded out by what they're asking here.
Would this be like the Men in Black?
Yeah, seemingly, yeah. Yeah, it gets a lot more weird. It gets way weirder.
Okay.
So he agreed that he'd seen a number of things to them. Yeah, he basically says, yes, I've seen a number of things. The man says, "The first thing you saw, was it a comet?" At this question, the lady opens up this holder bag that she's got with her, and she takes out this folder, and she starts flicking through the pages of this folder, and you can see it from across the, the other side of the room. And in this folder is a number of UFO photographs, pictures, some of them in color, some of them in black and white. And she starts flicking from page to page, and she stops at this particular page and holds it up to him. She says, "Did you see this?" And it's the object. It's the comet. It's the white comet object with the tail that he saw. But even more strange is not just the object. He said that it looked exactly as he remembered it, as in from his own point of view, almost like they'd been there standing alongside him on the street and had taken a photograph of this thing, and that's how it would have come out. So he's very puzzled. They then flick to another page without saying anything more. They flick to a second page, hold up the folder again, and it's the object, it's the disc. It's the disc-shaped object in a horizontal position before it started to rotate. And again, it was almost like it was from his own mind. It was like the photograph was a still from how he remembered it, from the upstairs bedroom window. So it was like they'd been standing in the room when they'd taken the shot. It was at a level with it. Absolutely bizarre. And they said, "Did you see this?" And he said, "Yeah." And they then asked him if he tried speaking to it. And he said that he did. And they said, "What about?" And he explained what he'd asked it in his mind and what the object then went and did. And then they asked him, if following on from it, did he have any issues with electronics or paranormal activity, this sort of thing, in the house? And he said that he didn't. But at this point, he's starting to become very unhappy with what's going on. He's really, really confused. Who are these people? How did they know about his sightings? How have they got photographs of the objects? And why do the photographs look like they're from his own mind? And he starts to tell him, "Okay, I've answered your questions. Now it's your time. You answer me some questions. Could you please tell me who you are?" And at this, they tell him that they're part of an investigative group who reviews sightings. But he's not satisfied with this at all. You know, this sort of very blasé response. And he says, "Are you able to tell me more? What's the name of the group? You know, what are the contact details?" And they apparently sidetracked this question, so sidestepped it a bit, and kind of looked at one another, and then basically said to him that it was time for them to go. Without thinking, he kind of goes along with it. So they stand up off the sofa. He leads them out without saying anything more, and he opens the door and then watches as they walk off down the road. He doesn't see them get into a car, and they just walk off until they're out of sight. And that's where the experience kind of ended for him. There's so many things that are wrong with that experience. Not only the fact that he hadn't told anybody, the fact that this happened years and years later after he'd moved address. So even if they had his address at the time, how did they know where he lived there? They knew his name. They knew where he lived. They knew that he'd had the experiences. You know, they were claiming to be some sort of blasé UFO investigation group, but when he asked them questions about what group it was or whether they had any contact details, they refused to answer those questions. It's just absolutely reeks of a Men in Black case. Now, obviously, these experiences don't happen too often. Yeah, I'd say in less than 10% of the cases I've investigated, at least, are there Men in Black experiences. But I have investigated quite a few where things like this have taken place. More often than not, they seem to be normal, as in human beings. Now, you could say there's aspects of this which seem supernatural, which is entirely true. But more often than not, they seem to be kind of actual government agents of some kind who are attempting to find out information from the experiences. So they'll ask them questions. So they don't often say, you're not allowed to tell anybody about this, don't mention this to anyone, although there are cases on record where that has happened. More often than not, they seem interested. It's almost like they're trying to find out more about the beings by speaking with the people that they, you know they've had contact with.
Yeah, it seems like the Men in Black are like everywhere, you know, UK, USA.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
they may have other names that they go under, but it seems like the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, obviously, these days, you know, the comedy film series has kind of given it a bit of a jokey edge to it, but it's based on actual cases. You know, the Men in Black exist. Now, exactly who they are or from what agency they're part of, you know, I certainly believe that not only are they real, I believe that they are part of the ongoing cover-up regarding this subject. And there's many, many high-profile cases on record. Some of the biggest cases on record that have happened over the years have aspects of Men in Black in, where people will turn up, usually wearing black suits. They're not always. I've dealt with cases in grey suits, brown suits, this sort of thing as well. But smartly dressed individuals, shall we say, that will ask questions and sometimes try to get people. Sometimes they'll even try to bribe people, and they'll say, we'll give you money if you don't talk about it. Really fascinating.
Right.
But yeah, an amazing case. And as I say, James, very, very trusted, very intelligent man. And I've taken him on as an investigator for the group.
I'll be right back with the rest of my conversation with Dave Hodrian when we discuss case number 6, right after these brief messages.
You awaken in a cold sweat. Your heart races and your breath quickens. It's 3 a.m., and you're not alone. Something lurks in the corner of the room, and it's darker than the night.
You're deep in the woods, enjoying a family camping trip. Marshmallows roast and laughs are shared until something screams from behind the ridge. It's neither human nor animal, but something in between. You can't see it, but it sees you.
You're driving down a dark, lonely road, singing along to your favorite song, when something dressed in white crosses your path. You swerve to an immediate stop and check your rearview mirror, but nothing's there.
The people are real, and the stories are legend.
The problem is that legends are often riddled in myth.
We uncover the truth. Tune in to Paratruth Radio every Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, anywhere podcasts are found.
I investigated this one back in 2016, and it involves a man named Simon, who I still speak with quite regularly, lovely chap. And again, this is a big case. So more often than not, contact cases tend to be quite detailed in nature. They're not just individual instances. He's had many experiences throughout his life, including paranormal activity, psychic-type premonitions, glowing orb sightings, this sort of thing. But again, I'm going to focus in on particular fascinating aspects of his case. Now, like some of the other cases we've been mentioning, Simon's case involves what's known as the hybrid program, where they appear to be making these offspring that are half alien, half human. Now, a lot of the time, these cases tend to involve females, ladies, but in this case, it's male involved with this one. It starts with a number of childhood visitations, and which he remembers going back to about age three. He remembers being visited in his room at night by a strange being. What would happen is he'd come around during the night and feel frightened. He didn't know why he was awake, just felt frightened. He felt there was something there in the room, and he'd pull the cover over his face to hide from whatever was there. But in the end, he'd have to peep. You know, it's just the anticipation of whether there really was anything there, and he'd peep out from underneath the covers, and he'd lift up the covers, and there would be this being standing alongside the bed. He described it as having a kind of wide and hairless, oval-shaped face, olive-coloured skin, but he thinks that could have potentially been down maybe to the darkness in the room, might have made it look like that. It had a large black eye patch over one eye, so it had one eye exposed, which was a normal almond-shaped black eye of a grey, but it had a black eye patch over the other eye, like a pirate's eye patch. Mm-hmm. And he said that the skin looked quite rubbery, almost like a puppet. And he'd be too frightened to run out of the room for call for help. He'd just sit there staring at this thing right near his bed. And then he'd hide back underneath the bedclothes. And then he thinks he'd black out at that point. He doesn't remember dropping back off to sleep. He was certainly very, very frightened. But he'd essentially pass out. And when he'd come around, it'd be morning time. Now, I've looked into many cases with the screen memory phenomena, where these beings, primarily the greys, I will say, tend to alter their appearance or the appearance of their environment. And it's possible that this is a screen memory caused by reminiscence. So if you think about the similarity of a large black grey's eye to a pirate's eye patch, it's possible that that's why he saw it wearing this eye patch, that its big black eyes reminded him of a pirate, and therefore he saw it with a pirate patch on. There's lots of cases on record where people see owls. And if you think about the similarity of an owl's face to a grey's face, there's a lot of similarity there. Especially barn owls with the white feathers and black eyes. Now, I'm not saying that that's the definite explanation for screen memories, but it's one of a number of potential conclusions, and it's one that's backed up with actual case records where you can see things, you can see similarities between what's observed. There's other cases I've dealt with where people have seen sort of old pilots, and the pilots are wearing black shades. And again, the black shades could be because of the large black eyes. They're, you know, the brain seeing them and therefore seeing sunglasses. We don't know for definite. But yeah, so he had those childhood visitations, doesn't remember any abduction experiences back then from his childhood. I'm going to fast forward now to 1998 or 1999. And at this point, he was either 30 or 31 years of age, living in a flat with his wife and his daughter. And by this point, numerous other things had happened. He'd had a couple of UFO sightings and other strange experiences, ghostly top phenomena, this sort of thing. But this was the first time that he had something that was definitely contact related since his childhood visitations. He woke up in the middle of the night and he found that he was paralyzed from the neck downwards. He was still in his room at this point, but there was a high-pitched whistling noise inside his head, and also the room appeared to be lit up in bright blue light. His wife was fast asleep alongside him. He felt almost encased in a clear bubble, almost like the surroundings of him was clearer than the rest of the room. He found that quite hard to explain, but he described it as being inside a clear bubble of some kind. He said that all of a sudden, this being pushed its face through this bubble and was staring right at him. And it looked different to the one he'd seen in childhood. This one had a kind of very flattened, oval-shaped face, brown, wrinkled skin, quite different to the normal greys. Still had black eyes. There's observations from other cases on record where this particular type, should we call it, subspecies of grey, whatever, have been seen, and they usually look a lot more sort of old and wizened, and have usually got this brown-coloured skin. At this point, the high-pitched noise, it increases in volume in his head, and then he feels like he's lifting up off the bed. So he comes up off the bed, and then all of a sudden, he feels he's dropped back down onto the bed, and at this point, he's no longer in his room. He's looking around, and what he describes is essentially a classic abduction experience. He's lying on a flattened metal bench or table of some kind. There's a very sterile looking environment around him with curved walls that are lit in white light that don't appear to have a source to them. Standing all around him, there's no other furnishings in the room, it's just that, for, as far as he can see. Standing all around him are these five or six glowing beings. They look humanoid and female in appearance, but there's a lot of light coming from them. They had long blonde hair, and these essentially look like they could have been Nordic beings, as we call them, the Nords. Nordics, they are almost as commonly seen as greys in cases, but many people don't realize that. A lot of people think that there was a lot of cases involving these beings back in the 60s and 70s and that sort of thing, but they're not so common anymore. That's not strictly true. And I've also dealt with cases which involve both Greys and Nordics working together, and this could well be one of these cases. He turns to look at the one nearest to him, and it no longer looks like this feminine being. It looks like the being that was in his room when he was back on the bed with the brown wrinkled skin. So it's possible that was again some kind of screen that was being put up. We don't know. He looks down and he finds his own clothes. So he's largely paralyzed, but he can move his head around. So he looks down himself. He realizes he's unclothed. He said that above his knees, above his legs, was a strange cube-shaped device hovering there in the air, seemingly. And attached to this was a tube, and the other end of it was basically over his genitals.
Whoa.
He had an uncomfortable pain in his groin, and he found that he could move his legs a bit, and he actually kicked one of the beings that was on to his right in the face. She reached out with his leg and booted it in the face. At this point, there's another one up behind his shoulder, puts his hand down on his forehead. And at this, he feels this intense cold sensation, almost like ice, just go through his head, and then there's darkness. So this being essentially had blacked him out. Now, I've dealt with other cases where exactly the same thing has been reported, and these are the kind of details that come out only through repeated examination of the contact phenomena. It's not the sort of thing you'll pick up from X-Files or whatever. At that point, he finds himself back in his room, but he's still up in the air, floating above his bed, and then he gets dropped forcefully down back onto the bed with a thud. At this actual movement, his wife actually stirs and almost wakes up, but then quickly drops back off to sleep again. He lies there waiting. He's still got a pain in his groin, and he assumes after that he lay there a while, and he assumes that he dropped back off to sleep. When he comes around, it's morning time, but he still feels discomfort, and he decides to check himself out in the mirror. He finds 4 to 5 red round dots on the base of his groin, and there's also a lump there. Obviously, he's worried that he doesn't think that's an implant. He's worried that it might be cancer or something. So he books in to see his GP, and the doctor arranges a visit to his local hospital for a scan. He went for this scan. All he found out was that it wasn't cancer. They said that it wasn't cancer, but that they didn't know what it was. That was what they said to him. And again, you're seeing parallels here with the Southampton case, completely separate. He was quite puzzled by this, but they didn't give him any further answers, and he went back home, not really knowing what the thing was. 2 days later, this lump had vanished, whatever it was. It was just gone. So it's possible that it was kind of caused by trauma in the area. We don't really know. Obviously, quite a disturbing experience there. Now going to move forward to 2001, so a year and a bit ahead of that experience, and he's now about 32 years old. He thinks it was roughly a year later.
Mm-hmm.
He has another abduction experience. It's really, really similar to before. Again, the room's lit up in blue. Again, he's got this high-pitched whistling noise in his ear. I will say that there is aspects of early-stage contact experiences that do fit in with hypnagogia, some of the unusual things that can happen with sleep paralysis. However, in sleep paralysis experiences, you only remain ever in your local environment. So when people get taken aboard craft and find themselves in completely different environments, that doesn't happen with sleep paralysis. There's definite differences. Essentially, he'd had this other abduction experience. This time, he's in a different location. He finds himself in this darkened room, this darkened area that he thinks is, he feels it's a large open space, although he can't see anywhere. He can just see localized. And he's sitting on this black colored chair that looks almost like it's made out of solid plastic. The temperature of this area is warm. And from the darkness steps forward this being approaching him. I can't remember what it looked like, primarily because his attention was drawn to something that it was holding. And what it was holding was what appeared to be an orange-brown coloured cone-shaped object. It had two blue dots on it, two round blue dots that looked like eyes. Now, this is really bizarre. Yeah, he sensed that this object, this strange cone-shaped thing, was alive, and he also sensed a deep emotional connection to it, like it was his own son or daughter. This being that he can't remember, and again, this has, again, you'll see the similarities. So if you think back to the Buxton case, again, when the lady was brought the being, when she was brought the baby, she remembers the baby and exactly what that looked like, but she couldn't remember what the being that brought it to her looked like. So it's exactly the same. And the being hands it him for several minutes, and he's allowed to hold it. So he's holding this weird cone-shaped thing, but he's treating it like a baby. And after that, the being reaches its arms out and takes it back. Now, Simon can't remember whether that was voluntary or whether it forcefully took this thing off him. But he then woke up in his bed crying. He was really, really emotional. And he felt like his child had been taken away from him. Now, it's extremely likely, from the cases I've looked at, I would say that it's extremely likely that that was a hybrid baby with a screen memory over it. So he was remembering it and seeing it in his vision as this cone-shaped thing with these blue eyes, these blue dots on it.
Yeah, I've heard about these hybrid babies, you know, they basically come from woman. This is the first time I've heard about the man.
Yes, yeah, it's quite rare to get this reported from a male perspective, but yeah, it shows that it does involve both sexes. So yeah, it's an absolutely fascinating experience. It's really interesting the fact that you've got the hybrid thing there, but you've also got what appears to be a screen memory, because it's very unlikely that it looked like an orangey cone-shaped thing with two blue eyes. It was completely inanimate. It wasn't moving. It was just this weird cone-shaped thing, and he was holding it, but treating it like a baby. Really bizarre.
Yeah, so you think they're making like the hybrid babies out of the human?
Yes, I think they've taken his DNA. So many experiences have actually seen these babies aboard craft during abductions, sometimes not related to their own experience. The only similarity we've got in the cases I've gone over is in part one. If you remember Buxton case, the lady describes seeing a fully grown adult female floating in a long glass cylinder. But a lot of the time people will report seeing actual babies, and sometimes these babies look completely human, and other times they look like half breeds. They've got aspects of both greys and humans to them. So it seems very likely that they are creating these things, and sometimes people will meet them later on. I've spoken with people who've had abduction experiences and have been introduced to their hybrid children, and sometimes even seen fully grown adult hybrids aboard the craft. Now, it's widely believed that these beings cannot, these crossbreeds can't survive on Earth. There's a lot of cases where people have been told that they need to remain aboard the craft. It's quite a mystery as to exactly why they're making them, which I think we delved into in part one, so I won't repeat myself on that one.
Well, what I thought was interesting is earlier you had mentioned the Nordics and the Greys working together.
Yes.
Because I've always been under the impression that they were the same species of evolved into the Greys.
Well, I mean, you've got there. I mean, with this one, it looks almost like it was a screen memory. Yeah, I've dealt with numerous cases where people have seen both Nords and whatever you want to call them. You can call them Pleiadians or humanoids or whatever you like. They've usually got very pale or blonde-coloured hair, though not always.
Some of the Greys have big eyes, and I've been told, and some blink, some don't blink.
But yeah, so it's either lots of different kind of subspecies, or they are intentionally messing with their genes and creating different subspecies themselves. So there seems to be a lot of interest in our DNA and our genetics. So they'll often take blood samples, hair samples, that sort of thing, to get hold of people's DNA. Maybe to create these hybrids with, maybe not. So I don't think that every single person who's been taken is going to be involved in the creation of hybrid beings, but they certainly appear to be doing it. You've just got all these cases from different places, and it sounds really wild, doesn't it? I mean, this is the really controversial deep aspects of the contact phenomena. This is, and it and it genuinely upsets people. You'll see that I mentioned that Simon was extremely emotional about the fact, and the lady from Buxton, I mentioned exactly the same thing last time. It's very troubling for people because it feels to them that their own child has been stolen from them. Mm-hmm. We don't really know why they're doing this. There seems to be an emotional bonding ritual of some kind, like they're bringing back the babies and allowing them to interact with their human father or mother for whatever reason.
Maybe say goodbye or something. I don't know. You know,
all we can see is the observations. Yeah, you know? And there's going to be some contactees out there who may have been told exactly why they're making them. Or uh-huh. may believe that they, you know, from what they've seen in their own experiences. And I don't want to offend anybody by belittling those experiences. I have to be very cautious because I've heard many, many things over the years, and I have to go with what the observations of the cases are showing me. Yeah, I tell you, it's wild.
And I take all these stories seriously, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I can understand why some people who haven't looked into the contact subject might feel that some of this stuff sounds too wild to be true. I totally get that. But these are people from completely different backgrounds. And even with these few cases that have mentioned aspects of the hybrid program, you'll have seen the similarities there. And that's just three cases. We've got hundreds of cases. It's something very real going on with it. Exactly why they're doing it and why they're making these things, we don't know. Maybe they're going to populate another planet. Maybe some people are quite alarmist with it and believe that they're going to at some point replace us with it. I mean, I haven't seen any evidence of that that's leading up to that. And I think maybe if that was the plan, it probably would have already happened. So, but we don't know because that's trying to humanize something that's not human. So we don't, you know, their time might work on a completely different level to us. Maybe for them, millions of years is just, you know, nothing at all.
This concludes part two of my conversation with Dave Hodrian from the Birmingham UFO Group. So join me next week when Dave comes back. We finish up with some bonus cases that Dave and I talked about. I'm your host, Al Cooley, Ghost in the Valley podcast.